Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Blog Talk.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. In March 2009, pretty vivacious Rhonda Casto plunged to her death from a 300-foot cliff in the Oregon woods. The only witness, Stephen Nichols, the father of her nine-month-old baby Annie, told police investigators she slipped and fell. Yet Nichols' story didn't quite mesh with the facts, and some of his other actions raised suspicions as well, including just days after her death trying to collect on $1 million life insurance policy he had taken out on his unemployed 23-year-old girlfriend 4 months earlier. What had begun with a 911 call to report an accident quickly turned into a homicide investigation. However, in part due to lackluster police work, the case grew cold. Then in 2011, Darty Robinson, a tenacious investigator with a Portland law firm, began digging into the circumstances surrounding Rhonda's death. The law firm represented Rhonda's mother, who believed that Nichols, 34 at the time, had murdered her daughter. She wanted to prevent him from gaining custody of Annie and the life insurance money. What Robinson discovered, including an attempt by Nichols to throw his first wife off a high-rise balcony in China, as well as sexual abuse allegations with Rhonda's underage sister, convinced her that Rhonda's death was no accident. So began her six-year battle to save Annie from her own father and find justice for Rhonda. In the meantime, a parallel investigation into the case by co-author Steve Jackson, an award-winning journalist and New York Times bestselling author, and private investigator Tom McCallum posed the same questions. What really happened to Rhonda Casto on that cold, rainy afternoon on the Eagle Creek Trail? And what would become of her child? The book that we're featuring this evening is Saving Annie, Book 2, The Investigator, with my special guest, Steve Jackson, journalist, author, and Wild Blue Press publisher, Steve Jackson. Welcome back to the program, and thank you very much for agreeing to this interview, Steve Jackson.
Thanks, Dan. It's always good to be here.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure to have you and some of the authors from Wild Blue Press as well. Let's talk about Saving Annie. This is the book two. Previously, I think a few weeks ago, 4, 5, 6 weeks ago, we had you talk about Saving Annie, book one. As you do in the prologue, you give a synopsis for those people that didn't get a chance to hear that. Let's talk about March 2009, Rhonda Casto, 23-year-old, as we mentioned in the introduction, gives us a little bit of a synopsis of what happened, as you do in the prologue, to Saving Annie, book two.
Well, yes. As you know, the way the books are set up there, it's one story told in four different books because that's the way the story breaks up, and we thought we'd experiment a little bit with serialization of books, and so we do a small synopsis at the beginning of each, which doesn't give you much of the details, but enough to remind people who have read the previous book of where we're at in the book. But anyway, in March of 2009, March 16th, 2009, Rhonda Casto and her boyfriend, who also was the father of her child, her infant, went for a hike up in the an area off the Columbia River Gorge in Oregon. And at some point in that hike, around 3 o'clock in the afternoon, Rhonda plunged from a almost 300-foot cliff. And a few hours later, her boyfriend, Stephen Nichols, called 911, and that is how the story begins.
Now, with this Stephen Nichols, of course, this book is called Saving Annie, so the daughter is 9 years old. What happens with Annie after her mother is missing and dead?
Just a small correction. It says Annie is at this time 9 months old.
Pardon me.
So she is still an infant. No, it's quite all right. It's one of those mistakes. But what happens with Annie is that at first she's left with her maternal grandmother, who is also accusing Nichols of having murdered Rhonda in part for a $1 million insurance policy that he took out on Rhonda, and in part because he's had a sexual affair going with Rhonda's younger sister since she was 15 years old, obviously a criminal act. At a point in here, around May, June of 2009, Nichols demanded Annie and from the grandmother, and she believed that she had to hand the child over to him. He took the child and moved in with his father and stepmother up in Bend, Oregon, which is central Oregon, as opposed to where they've been living in Portland.
Now, Nichols has gotten a lawyer, so he's refused to talk to the lead investigator in this in Hood River Sheriff's Office, and that's Detective Sergeant Jerry Tiffany. And when we mentioned about the insurance claim, and so they all know about him trying to get that insurance claim, and that we mentioned also that it's highly suspicious when he just purchased the insurance policy, and then she ends up dead. Now, with the police and their suspicions, but yet he gets a lawyer and refuses to talk to police, makes this move to Bend, Oregon, moves in with his family. What is the living arrangement there in Bend, Oregon? And then when do you introduce Dartie Robinson and how she comes into the picture here in this story?
Well, Stephen and Annie, as we said, move in with his father and stepmother. They live a few miles out of Bend, Oregon, in a community known as Sun River, sort of a wooded, semi-rural area. You know, in the forest, I guess. And so that's where they're living at this time. Julia Simmons, the child's maternal grandmother, one is trying to prevent Nichols from collecting the money, the insurance policy, and she's also wants custody of the child. So that she, and some of these machinations are going on during this time. Ms. Simmons actually thinks that if anybody's going to get the insurance money, she should, and get the child, so that the money is being used on the child, and it's in her possession. So as she's doing this, she goes to the a victim's assistance program in the county where she's living, and they refer her to Darty Robinson, who is a paralegal working for an attorney in Portland named Robert Barton, a former prosecutor in Orange County. And the whole purpose is Darty has signed up through her church to do some free legal work for people. And so she's told about this story about this woman who is trying to gain custody of her granddaughter, and also prevent the child's father, who she believes killed her daughter, from getting the money. So this interests Darty, who has her own history of children being sexually abused, and so it kind of strikes a heartstring with her when she hears about this. And so she invites Ms. Simmons to their law office to hear her story.
Now, this Darty, you talk about that she's had many things in her life so that she can be empathetic towards this, and also, as you write in this book, take this on like a personal crusade to be able to save this child. Tell us a little bit about her background before this fortuitous meeting at this, through the church, and then when she goes to her employer, basically, Bob Barton, and pleads her case to be able to take this and do what's necessary. Tell us a little bit about Darty Robinson and her background that shaped her for this.
Yeah, Darty's a very interesting person just in her background, and has faced a lot. She was raised by some missionary parents who actually took her to Africa when she was young, and they lived there for a number of years, and then before returning. And she's an accomplished pianist, but the dark side of this is she was also molested twice by two different people, I should say, more than twice, but two different people during her childhood and when she was a teenager. So, of course, that brings its own trauma and into it. But also, even more tragically, is that Darty was married and had a family with a number of children. And one day, one of her daughters came to her and said that her husband, Darty's husband, the child's father, had molested her. And this, of course, just threw everything into chaos. Darty went to the police with the allegations. Her husband was arrested. He was a very well-known man. They lived in Washington, the state of Washington at this time. And so he, you know, he denied it, of course, and Darty went through hell with a lot of church people and other people accusing her of making all this up and that sort of thing. And until well into all of this, her husband, former husband at this point, finally confessed, which of course vindicated Darty. But she now had a shattered family with daughter who had been sexually molested as she had been. So it's sort of the one of those things where, she's very empathetic to the plight of children. Darty is would put any child ahead of herself. And so when she hears about this story about Ron DeCasso's child living with the man who possibly killed her mother and is having an affair with the mother's younger sister, it definitely motivates her to get involved.
It's interesting, and I think it's important to mention, too, that because of this, again, we talked about this tenacious character, and she has to have that to pursue this campaign, is that she wanted to give her husband 30 years at one point. She went to the district attorney and she fought and did an investigation and brought those investigative skills to her new career as a paralegal as a result of the things that she was able to accomplish to protect her children. And he got a maximum, he got 5 years through that. She convinced the judge that he should get that kind of sentence. And then that brought those, as you write, those investigative skills to her new career at this legal firm. How does she convince Bob Barton that he should get involved? And once he isn't involved, what do they do in terms of trying to get this before a district attorney and have these charges followed up on that she has done this work for and investigated? And about Stephen Nichols.
I'm sorry, Dan. I lost track of you there. What is the question?
Well, once she goes to Barton at the law firm, what is the next move with in terms of relationship with police?
Okay. That's what I had not understood. They begin what they basically are doing here is they are. The case that they take on, Ms. Simmons, the grandmother, has already filed a custody case trying to get the child. So she has a lawyer for that. So what she's what Darty and Bob Barton initially start out to do is to prevent Stephen Nichols from getting the money from the insurance case. And what Darty wants to do is to make sure that this money is put aside for the child into the future, obviously thinking that the child may have some issues to deal with, but also just, the whole idea of this man who that she quickly learns the police believe killed the mother, and the insurance company has refused to pay off on this policy at this time. Due to, concerns that Stephen Nichols may have murdered Ron DeCasso. So that's how they initially get started. They don't start to try to prove that Nichols did anything to Rhonda. They start with the idea of let's stop him from getting the money right now. And then if we have to, we'll file a wrongful death, which is a civil version of a murder charge. And it's kind of as she's starting to do this that she's learning that there's a lot more to this whole case. There's the case of the younger sister who was being sexually exploited by Stephen Nichols when she was only 15 years old. Nichols goes up to, when he moves to Bend and is living up there with Annie, gets in trouble for sexually molesting a 13-year-old girl in a swimming pool. So he basically can't keep his hands to himself or anything else during, this is 8 months after Rhonda's death. He's already getting in trouble for this sort of thing. And so Daugherty starts to get more and more alarmed. Not only is Nichols possibly the murderer of Annie's mom, Rhonda, but he sexually molests underage girls. So, of course, that starts to raise concerns.
At the same time, you say that Robinson is trying to get information from the police, from Jerry Tiffany, and he's not being cooperative, yet she is providing information she believes and asking him and reaching out to him to see if she can help in any way. What is his response to her reaching out to try to help?
Well, basically, during this period of time, she was, I guess to put it politely, the police investigation a year after Rhonda's death has pretty much stalled. There are a number of witnesses who were never even interviewed, including Nichols' former wife and a former girlfriend who had filed domestic violence charges against him. He had lawsuits with his siblings were suing him for stealing money from a trust, which is yet another motive for him needing a lot of money fast, as he was being sued for about $500,000 by his siblings. And all of this stuff had not been run down by the police investigation, which was supposed to be headed by Sergeant Tiffany. So Tiffany, as she started to feed him information, hoping that he would reciprocate and give her information, basically would take her information, say thank you, but then say he couldn't tell her anything because it was an ongoing investigation. Curious as to what ongoing investigation, since he had not interviewed some witnesses or interviewed them late, or it wasn't doing anything much with these as far as Daugherty could tell or any sort of paperwork.
So how do they it's very interesting with the wrongful death civil suit and the aim of that in terms of the purpose behind this. And you explain what the difference is between a civil suit and you, of course, the best example is O.J. Simpson. And then you explain the difference in terms of preponderance of evidence. But tell us about why they thought of this, how it came to them, and explain the difference in the civil and criminal cases and why they thought that this would be an advantage for them.
Well, there's a couple of things going on here. They file a wrongful death, which, as you noted, is very similar to what happened in the O.J. Simpson case, where O.J. was tried in the criminal court and found not guilty. So the families of Ron Goldman and Nicole Brown Simpson sued in civil court with what's called a wrongful death suit. As we all know, in a criminal case, the evidence, the state has to prove a case beyond a reasonable doubt, which is fairly high bar. It's not beyond any and all doubt, as some people will say, but it's beyond a reasonable doubt, which and you have to have a unanimous jury verdict to convict somebody in a criminal case on with a murder conviction. With a wrongful death, you are basically, it's the preponderance of an evidence would lead, the jury to believe that he was indeed guilty of having caused the death of the victim, in this case, Rhonda Casto. And it doesn't require a unanimous jury. It's a majority, a simple majority. And, of course, in the criminal case, there's the possibility of imprisonment as well as fines and that sort of thing. With the civil case, it's a matter of money and getting a settlement from the defendant. In this case, with Rhonda, there's a couple of things they're trying to accomplish. One is that if Nichols, the insurance company, turned around and gave Nichols the money because he was suing the insurance company for this money. And if they turned around and gave it to him, they wanted to make sure they could sue Nichols and hopefully get the money that way for Annie through the wrongful death lawsuit. And the other part is that if Nichols was sued, they'd be able to depose him, which in a criminal trial, we all know that the defendant isn't required to take the stand in his own defense.
Right.
Most don't take the stand because then you subject yourself to cross-examination, questions, and all that sort of thing. But in the civil suit, Nichols would have had to have been deposed under oath, which means they could have asked him questions about the circumstances of Rhonda's death, and in the same sort of cross-examination that would have happened in a criminal trial, except for with a deposition. And then, of course, he could have been brought to the stand during the civil during the trial part of the civil suit and questioned on the stand with the attorney, of course, having the record of what he said in the deposition. So in a way, it's a way of forcing him to answer questions about Rhonda's death, which he had refused to do after the initial couple of interviews with police the night of. And so this is a sort of a way to get to him without it being a criminal case. And, of course, at this time, the difference between the O.J. Simpson case and this case was there was no criminal case yet against Nichols, no murder case. So whatever he had said in a deposition during the civil case or if he took the stand during the civil case, could have also been used in a future criminal case. And that's the importance of what they were trying to do there.
Absolutely. Very, very unique. And I thought that was a very fascinating part of this case, one of them anyway. Let's talk about, too, February 3rd, 2011, and Darty Robinson and Bob Barton. Why are they livid, as you write? What's gone on in Deschutes County that's made them angry?
Well, this goes back to Stephen Nichols he's arrested and indicted for 5 counts, felony counts, of sexual abuse of a minor from this incident that took place 8 months after Rhonda's death up in Bend in the swimming pool. You know, this is important to them for a number of reasons. One is they believe he's a sexual abuser. He's guilty of sexual assault. And also that, you know, now it could give them some leverage to get farther into the Rhonda Castro case. So anyway, they've gone up and they've talked to the prosecutor in the Deschutes County District Attorney's office after Nichols was indicted, and for a good half year, or actually more than a half year, almost a year and a half of all this, you know, the Nichols get some good defense attorneys, they stall, they get asked for other times. They investigate. They, of course, go after the 13-year-old and try to paint a bad picture of her. There's a lot of this sort of thing going on. And so, Darty and Bob Barton are very interested in that the prosecutor stays on the case and goes after him for the felonies. Which will also give him a sexual assault felony, while this other case of sexual assault down in Portland on Rhonda's younger sister is also being investigated. So the prosecutor up there, a woman named Jody Bond, assures them for during this whole time that she's not going to plead this case. She's going to continue to press for felony charges. She's very competent. She's very good. She's done sex cases for a number of years. And so it looks like they're going to go to trial in January of 2011. But shortly before there's an election, and there a new district attorney is elected. And one thing, he fires all of the former deputy district attorneys, including Jody Bond, when this is going on. And then he directs another deputy district attorney, one who's still there, to plead the case out. So basically, they pleaded out to a misdemeanor sexual molesting case. Nichols gets a slap on the wrist, essentially, and suddenly that case goes away.
Right. You also say that fortunately, Darty Robinson obtained a certified copy of the Deschutes County file and a certified copy of the audio tape of the sentencing hearing. And you say years later, you write, years later, it would prove crucial. We'll just stop for a second to talk about our sponsor, which is Third Love. Using millions of real women's measurements, Third Love designs its bras with breast size and shape in mind for an impeccable fit and incredible feel. Third Love is the industry leader with 70 sizes, including its signature half-cup sizes. The details make the difference, from premium fabrics to expert design. Skip the trip. Find your fit in 60 seconds with Third Love's online fit finder. Order and try on at home. No more awkward fitting room experiences. Over 10 million women have taken the quiz to date. It's actually fun and takes less than a minute to complete. Did you know breast shape matters when finding a good fit? Third Love helps you identify your breast size and shape and find styles that fit your body. Hands down, the most comfortable bra you'll own. My wife Lisa received her classic t-shirt bra from Third Love. She was a bra fitter for 8 years professionally. She said the cup shape was very, very flattering and the bra itself very, very comfortable. The quiz to find the perfect bra for her really helped, she said. She loves her Third Love bra. Third Love knows there's a perfect bra for everyone. So right now, they're offering my listeners 15% off their first order. Go to thirdlove.com/true now to find your perfect fitting bra and get 15% off your first purchase. thirdlove.com/true. Steve, we talked about the frustration that Darty Robinson was experiencing with this incredibly lenient sentence, especially when they were agreed to, that they were hoping for and been promised a much more harsh sentence for him, a more appropriate sentence. So what do Darty Robinson and Bob Barton do next?
Well, obviously, as you said, this is very disappointing for them. You know, that with everything else seeming to stall, the sexual assault investigation down in Portland on the younger sister, the murder case doesn't seem to be going anywhere, so all they can do at this moment is just continue with their plan to stop Nichols from getting the money from the life insurance policy and keep gathering information and sending it to Jerry Tiffany, hoping that at some point he will put a case together and do something about Ron DeCasso's death. They are convinced by this time, because they've done their own investigation, probably a better investigation than the police had done. I think that's actually fairly obvious, and were as convinced as any of the police detectives, and a number of them were convinced. Jerry Tiffany has said he was convinced that Nichols was responsible, but another number of other detectives who weren't in charge had also believed it. And so do Daugherty and Bob Barton. And remember, Bob Barton was a former prosecutor in Orange County, which is a very large district attorney's office, as opposed to the very tiny district attorney's office in Hood River County, which is the county where Rhonda was murdered, or died, I guess I should say, at this point. So all they can do is keep trying to gather information, talk to witnesses, get them on the record. As you noted, Daugherty got a copy of the Nichols sentencing hearing and the plea deal he got because, as you said, this will come into play later in and actually will appear in book three, its importance. So they just continue with their investigation, just realizing that somehow Nichols keeps slipping through the fine machinations of justice, I guess.
We talk about that years later would prove crucial. You talk about that certified copy of the audio tape of the sentencing hearing and just the copy of the Deschutes County file itself. What did they get, especially from that audio tape of the sentencing hearing? What does Daugherty and Bob Barton realize and have as ammunition, per se, in that sentencing hearing?
Well, I think that the part of what it is that they have a record now that he of what he had done and both his remarks to the police when they came over, they were investigating this, and they came over and he essentially admitted to what he had done. Also the 13-year-old girl and her parents, some of the texts that Steve Nichols sent to this 13-year-old, very sexually suggestive. He sent a photograph with himself posing shirtless in front of a mirror. And this is a 34-year-old guy sending this sort of thing to a 13-year-old girl. And so this is all preserved, which, as we've said, will come in to play later on in this. So, that basically is that they're building this case that they believe should have been being built by the police.
You talk about October 11th, 2011, regarding the wrongful death, and you call it a cross claim. Tell us what happens in that case.
Well, the wrongful death is eventually thrown out, which wasn't entirely unexpected. A judge says this is not the right venue for it. That would be more of a federal case. And so it gets thrown out, but it serves its purpose of the insurance company can't settle with Nichols and give him the money. And there was also a guardian ad litem who wanted some of the money. Everybody wants all this money except for Annie. And that's Daugherty's, of course, main objective is to make sure that Annie gets the money. So they depose the insurance company agent who sold this insurance policy to Rhonda, and a lot of things come out. There's items like originally they had asked for a smaller amount, $500,000 on Rhonda and Steve both. And that was when Rhonda was present. Then when the agent got back to his office, Steve called him up and asked if they could raise it to, actually he wanted $1.4 million on Rhonda's. But after a couple of weeks of negotiating back and forth, they settled on a $1 million policy, which is very questionable in the first place. You don't give a $1 million policy for a young woman who was unemployed, had no assets, was, as a matter of fact, on welfare and food stamps because Stephen Nichols did very little to support her or her child.
And so this
is a mistake in the first place by this insurance company. And for this very reason is that you don't, give somebody an insurance policy that provides a motive to murder somebody else. And there usually is requirements of, being able to prove a certain amount of income for that is somewhat close to what you're asking as an insurance policy. It's also the quickness that, Steve Nichols is very anxious to have this done and done quickly. And it's done, I believe, first applies in November. They're given the, after this back and forth and settling on $1 million, they go back to, they get the policy is awarded to them in December and they receive it in January. There's a number of lies on both applications. So the whole thing was a mess. The insurance agent who sold it to him was very inexperienced, and he did not get much help from the higher-ups in the office. And so they depose him, and all of this comes out about how this was arranged and arranged very quickly. And I believe they get the insurance policy sign on it in January, and of course Rhonda is dead 2 months later.
As part of this too, in October 2011, you talk about the settlement that was reached about the money. Tell us how the court rules on that money dispersion.
Well, there is a settlement. The court doesn't actually make the decision. They agree with it once it's made. And basically, Steve Nichols did not want to be deposed. He did not want to go under oath and be asked questions that could be used later to match against whatever he told the police and whatever he might say or have exposed in a criminal trial.
Right.
So he agrees that he's going to release any sort of hold he has on the money. And so the only money Steve Nichols actually gets out of this is to pay his attorneys off, which was a chunk of money, several hundred thousand dollars. And the rest of the money goes into a trust for Annie. And that's sort of where the book two ends up with. Darty has been successful at stopping Nichols from getting any of this money. The remainder of the money, as well as interest on it, is in a trust with Annie. Now, at this point, Steve Nichols is still her guardian, has custody of her, and he's allowed to use the money for her needs, not his, but hers, such as dance lessons or clothing or things along those lines. But he's supposed to be held under a very there's somebody watching over this trust who he has to report the expenditures to, and this will also come into play in later books as to how he manipulates this somewhat. But the main point and ending for book two is that Darty and Bob Barton have done what they set out to do, which is to make sure Steve Nichols doesn't receive this money and that it's put aside for Annie. But the last part of book two is that at this point, Darty is determined that not only will Steve Nichols not receive any money, but he'll answer to justice for the death of Rhonda Castro if she has anything to do with it.
You talk about that, but we didn't mention how much does she find out? How much do her and, as a result, Bob Barton know about the particulars of this case that looks, from anyone looking at, looks like an obvious murder?
Well, there are some indications. She doesn't know everything at this point. She does know that his some of what he tells the police doesn't match, the facts, and that he changes his stories. She has heard a number of things, both from family members and friends, that Nichols had basically made some threats in the past. Of course, there's the $1 million insurance policy as one motive. There's another motive that he's obsessed with the younger sister and wants Rhonda out of the way so he can be with her. Even tells her at some point that Annie will forget her mom and the younger sister can step in and be the mom. There's he makes claims such as that he went and bought an engagement ring and was going to propose to Rhonda on this trail from which she fell, and that was the reason they were up there on a rather nasty weather day. But there's no proof that he ever bought it. In fact, they go to the jewelry store where he claimed to have purchased this, and they said no, they were in here, but nobody ever bought anything. So he's getting caught in lies. For one thing, and why do you lie if the truth serves you? He has the two sexual assault on minors cases. The one, of course, we just talked about, he ends up with a slap on the wrist because of the district attorney. And the other one is still being investigated at this time. And so there's just a lot of, it's a circumstantial case. There were no witnesses to when Rhonda fell. There is a witness that Darty at this time is not yet aware of, who was the search and rescue guy who was the first, with his partner, were the first to reach Rhonda's body. And right. What they found there, we talked in the first segment about how that did not match Nichols' story either. So she's just, she's like any good investigator. You know, there's a point where a tipping point where you're convinced of something. And so now you've got to go see if you can put together a case. And if you can, present it to somebody who will take this forward. Darty by this time has talked to Stephen Nichols' former wife, who told her that when they were living in Shanghai at one point, he attempted to first smother her and then tried to throw her off a balcony of an 8th-floor balcony in Shanghai, China, which, you know, you start putting things together of modus operandi, which is throw somebody off of a high of a balcony or a cliff or whatever else, and then in his history of sexual assault and physical assault, and, particularly with women, and so this sets her off on quest number two, which is to pursue. She's protected Annie and even though Annie is still in the possession of Steve Nichols, which she's now trying to work on that custody case, the first custody lawyer does not do a very good job, and in fact doesn't do anything and is eventually disbarred as a result of this and some other cases. But so they take on the custody case as well. Even though Bob Barton now has kind of done his job and is backing out of it, but he allows Darty to continue forward trying to put together the evidence needed for a murder case.
And you talk about two – sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead.
you talk about the she and Barton had asked to meet with the Hood River district attorney named Sewell. Sounds like, if I'm not correct, it sounds like they're trying to go over someone's head to try to appeal to this district attorney. What's the result of that? I know we probably said
First of all, they try to go through Tiffany saying, we'd like to, go talk to district attorney Sewell. And Tiffany is sort of, well, why do you want to do that? And there's like, well, we'd like to, present what we think is the case and maybe help you get some support and, to keep going forward with this and that sort of thing. But at this point, nothing much comes of it yet. And once again, that will be handled in book 3 and 4. And how that comes to change over time and some of the other things that happen during this period of time.
You write in the book that, very cryptic, you talk about Rhonda talking to her aunt about the proposed trip to go hiking that day. Tell us if she knew about that and what that claim was from the aunt.
Well, the aunt and the grandmother actually both claimed that they received a text from Rhonda that about the hike. Steve had been talking about going on this hike for some time, and and he tells the police a bunch of varying stories, everything from they wanted to lose weight to where he wanted to propose to her in a romantic spot, various stories. But the aunt and the grandmother said they receive a note from Rhonda shortly before they leave for this hike saying he either wants to propose to me or shove me off a cliff. And that, of course, this is the day that she dies. It's sort of one of those prescient sort of statements of what happens. Nichols will come along later and they're lying about that. Didn't keep the text. So there's no proof of this. On the other hand, when you're looking at this as an investigator, the police go over to the house on the night Rhonda dies. They've been told she's dead. They go over there to break the news, and without having any time to kind of come up with a story or make these sorts of things up, they make these statements. They make the statements about that there's a life insurance policy. The aunt and the grandmother say she told us he was either going to propose or throw her off a cliff. So, if you don't realize the kind of timing of this, you could say, okay, well, this is an upset, angry family. They came along later. Maybe they want the insurance money, so they make up all these things. They didn't have time for that. They didn't have time to put their heads together and say, okay, what you should say is this and what you should say is that. And when you're building a circumstantial case, a good prosecutor has to be very aware of making sure the jury understands that very thing, is that there is no time here to come up with this kind of a story with this kind of detail.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you also talk about that we mentioned in the introduction too as well, that a parallel investigation into this case is being conducted by yourself and private investigator Tom McCallum, and you say posing the same questions. Tell us a little bit about investigator Tom McCallum and just this parallel investigation that is being conducted at the same time.
Well, this starts to happen right about the time when the insurance case is wrapping up, and Darty is has done what she wanted to do, has saved the money for Annie, is now starting her custody part of the case, as well as looking into justice for Ron DeCasto, and we're completely unaware of her. Tom is from a very, very wealthy man in the Bend area of Oregon, and he has some concerns because his daughter, who is going through a divorce, is dating this guy that he and all their friends find kind of creepy. This guy, you know, he's got a young child now, you know, a year and something, 8 years old, almost two. He's hanging around her daughter. He, with his kind of money, you know, he checks out everything. So he has Tom to run a background check. That of course, becomes book three. Sort of interesting, Tom and I had met in 1989, I believe, when I was living in Oregon, and the Oregon Department of Corrections head was murdered in a parking lot outside of the Oregon Department of Corrections building. And it became the police and prosecutors tried to paint this story that he had been surprised by some burglar as he was getting into his car, but none of that added up. A young man was arrested about a year after it happened. And everything I've been doing up to that point, investigating, I'd probably written several hundred stories all told, maybe not quite that many by this time, but I suddenly got a call from the defense investigator for the young man who had been arrested, and he wanted me to sit down with him and talk about how I found out what I'd found out. And at first I told him to bug off. I wasn't sharing anything with anybody. And that happened for a couple of times. And finally, this guy, Tom McCollum, volunteered to buy me lunch. And as you know, all journalists will go for a free lunch. So we ended up meeting, and it became fast friends after that. Have done some different investigations together. So when Tom got a call from this billionaire, and this is the start of book three, and Tom discovers that this guy, this creepy guy, whose name is Stephen Nichols, had just some domestic violence charges, restraining orders against him, and was possibly a suspect in a murder case. Obviously, this raises a bunch of red flags, and Tom decided he needed a little help on the investigation, so he called me, and I drove out in January of 2012, and we started our investigation, which, as you note, parallels a lot of what Daugherty had done and is still doing at this time, though we are unaware of her for probably the next 6 months. And
yeah,
that's the start of book three.
Absolutely. And it's called The Journalist and the Private Eye, and book four is called Case Closed. Tell us when book three is going to be released. Hopefully it isn't released yet, but tell us when it's going to be released, and book four, when it's slated to be released.
Book three is going to be released shortly after Christmas. In fact, there may be a little Christmas present for everybody on that one.
Wow.
We're still working out details. And then book four will come out in January. And for those who don't want to read books in parts, even though we think it's kind of an exciting way, we've had lots of people tell us that it's kind of fun to have something to look forward to. But
sure.
People who don't want to read it that way, in late February, we'll probably be releasing the entire book, or all four books combined into one. So if you'd rather wait until then, you can, or you can stay up with everybody else on what's going on in the case.
Absolutely. I think it's a real success doing it this way. Like I had mentioned to you beforehand, I said it just really draws you more, even more so, into the characters that are involved in this. As you say, you weren't even aware of people that heroic people, heroic efforts to be able to solve this case, and then without that knowledge, you and Tom McCallum undergo and undertake this investigation on your own as well. And it's a fascinating case and a fascinating way of delivering this story to the audience, I think. So I want to thank you very much for coming on and talking about Saving Annie, Book 2, The Investigator. Thank you very much, Steve Jackson. For those people that might not know about Wild Blue Press, can you just give us a little bit of information? I know many authors that have been on this program are from the Wild Blue Press stable of authors. Tell us a little bit about Wild Blue Press and how they might look at your other work and the roster of fine authors.
Wild Blue Press, we're an indie publishing company. We like to say we're an A through Z company, that we have the best of traditional publishers along with the best of indie publishers. We specialize in particular in true crime as well as thrillers and mysteries, so we have a couple of histories and are hoping this year to expand into some other genres. But you can find out all about us at wildbluepress.com. That's wildbluepress.com, all one word. And to find our list of authors, we have some great true crime that is that this fall has just been one great book mm-hmm. after another.
Absolutely.
And going to continue into the new year. We like to think that we're the leading publisher in true crime right now.
Absolutely, Steve. I want to congratulate you on that. An incredible, diverse group of authors and subjects, and I think it's taken true crime where it needed to go. I think some of the other, obviously the big publishers, have not got their got the pulse of the reader, the true crime reader. So I think Wild Blue Press has certainly got the lion's share of all the real good true crime authors and the fantastic stories that they've written about. I want to thank you very much, Steve, for coming on and talking about Saving Annie, Book 2, The Investigator. You have a great evening. Thank you very much, Steve Jackson.
You too, Dan. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you. Good night.